Hello, this is Albert Einstein. History myths fly around at the speed of light. Especially with that new internet thing you all seem to have. Thank goodness, I have a direct connection to Professor Buzzkill, a fellow deep thinker who busts myths and takes names. I'm totally stoked there's a new episode. I was stuck on this new equation anyway. E equals MC something. Something.
Indeed, indeed, indeed. It's Professor Buzzkill here, busting myths, taking names. Today we have with us in the Buzzkill bunker, Professor Philip Nash, your favorite Buzzkiller. Professor, how are you?
You are too kind. Happy to be here.
Well, we're doing something different this episode. We're actually looking at a year, devoting an entire show to just one year. And what a year it was, 1919.
Absolutely. Yeah. We normally, like we were talking, I don't think we've done a show on just a year. And this is, by the way, just on the United States.
Yes, that's right.
So a year in the life of the United States.
And rather than doing it the early part of 2019, we're doing it near the end of 2019 because we thought it would be best to sort of look back, if you will, and take in the whole of what was going on in 1990, right? Because it just is enormously crammed with very fascinating events.
Yeah. And, you know, this is going to sound odd when you look at these arbitrary lengths of time called years.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we're going to be doing a 1922 show anytime soon. I mean, there were some major events that year, but there were some years. We did a 1968 show, and that's one of those years where I would argue there are more than a year's worth of events backed into that year.
Yeah,
it's almost like cataclysmic. And I would argue, as you'll see, 1919 is one of those years.
But of course, everybody does 1968 shows, and no one does 1919 shows, and that's why we're so pioneering.
Exactly. You heard it here first. So just a little bit of context. There's, as we'll see, there's a lot of chaos in the United States in 1919. There's a lot of chaos in the world.
Yeah.
1919. Yeah. And it bugs me because I don't remember where I saw this. I saw it recently. It was a claim, and I was unable to verify it. I think it's probably true. It's a grain of salt. But the argument was that more people died unnatural, so premature deaths,
right,
in the period 1919 to 1923, then died during World War One,
which is astounding. Because
if that's even a little bit true, that is amazing.
Right,
by the way,
and
I don't even think that counts the influenza pandemic.
No,
because that's definitely true.
Yeah.
Many more people died in that.
Yeah.
Worldwide than died in World War One. So leave that aside. But if you look at things like the Russian Civil War, the famine in Russia at the same time, 1921, I believe, it killed millions.
Right.
So there's so many things going on in the world in this period. You know, the Amritsar massacre in India, example. I mean, there's the struggles in Ireland.
Think of all these flashpoints. You know, there's a World War One flashpoint, and there's a World War II flashpoint. No, it seems it's constantly
in between,
going on.
Right, in the interwar years.
Yeah.
There's
an
unbelievable amount of mayhem. So the book that we're going to put on the bookshelf, the Buzzkill bookshelf, is a book by Anne Hagedorn about 1919, and it's called Savage Peace.
Savage Peace,
and
right.
I think that's not a bad, if I can put a bumper sticker on this episode, I think that's a pretty good one, Savage Peace. It's like, it's a kind of good news, bad news. We're at peace, but boy, what kind of a peace is it really?
Yeah, you would think, you know, how bad can it be? It's that the war is over.
Right.
The USA helps win the war. It's itself is unscathed. Bring the boys home. You know, why is 1919 proved to be a bad year?
Right, because on paper you'd think, right, this is your first full year of peace after this really bad war that, like you implied, was not so bad for the United States compared to the other major combatants. Right, we were not invaded. American homes weren't burned to the ground.
No,
right,
no.
We didn't suffer like Northern France did, for example.
No trenches.
But if you look at 1919 in the United States, it's difficult to know where to begin. Maybe we should begin most basically with the economy.
Mm-hmm.
And the comparison to World War II is instructive, and I'm assuming that's partly because we had this learning experience.
Right.
But basically, you're going to have economic dislocation after you've mobilized for a major war, right, where you've mobilized so much of your society, like the United States did in 1917 and 1918. But still, unemployment had sunk to 3% during the war.
Oh, okay.
Because obviously, industry was humming, and you had put 4 million people in uniform. Mm-hmm. So you have created an artificially low unemployment rate.
Yes, right, right.
So, which almost always happens, but right? Then you've got the flip side of that, which is very rapid demobilization, right? Intense pressure to bring the boys home.
Yeah.
So in early 1919 already, you've gone from a labor shortage to a labor glut because you have all these, able-bodied people who, many of whom had left jobs, who now come and want to work.
Sure.
The whole demobilization process in the United States was marked by very little planning. Troops returned with very little cash, no benefits.
Mm.
And already in 1919, the economy begins to slide. So I'm cheating a bit here because the really, really bad years of the economy after World War I, apart from the Great Depression, obviously, are 1920 and 1921.
Yeah.
But what you have in 1919 is you have inflation that remains at a wartime rate. And if you look at the consumer price index, the inflation rate in the last year of war, 1918, was over 17%.
Wow.
Which, by the way, is actually not bad for a major country at war.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
It's certainly high for peacetime. Mm. And in 1919, it remains at about 17%.
Huh.
And wages are not going up commensurately. So people's buying power is being eroded even in this first year of peace.
Yeah, and the glut of people coming back only makes
Exactly. And so that causes a great deal of hardship. And basically, we're headed toward a recession. And what's going to happen is the inflation rate is going to drop to below zero, and you're going to have deflation, and you're going to have an 18-month recession.
Which is another problem.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
You have an 18-month recession in 1920 and 21. Uh-huh. And the unemployment rate in 1921 is going to reach almost 12%. So it's not a depression, but it is an extremely serious recession that often gets overlooked, right? We always talk about, the World War I and the Roaring Twenties, and then we talk about the Great Depression.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This, I mean, obviously the depression is going to be much, much, much worse,
mm.
but this is some real economic pain, widespread economic pain in the immediate aftermath of the war.
Okay, well, apart from the obvious, then what effect does this high inflation have?
Well, like I said, it's eating into wages, and why that matters in the post-war environment is, in the post-war environment, I'll put it very simply, it is no longer unpatriotic to strike as labor, right? Because you had, and you see the same thing in World War II, not necessarily by law, but by sort of a tacit agreement that's considered unpatriotic for major labor unions to go on strike in the middle of war.
Sure.
For obvious reasons, right? You have to keep the machines humming.
Yeah.
And so what it means is that, in effect, you have this long-term pent-up strike demand, right? In other words, you're sort of itching to strike and you can't do it until the war's over.
Right.
Well, in 1919, what you have is labor unrest on an extremely widespread scale. You have major strikes in the steel industry.
Yeah.
And you have major strikes in the coal industry. And remember, in 1919, the U.S. economy still runs largely on coal.
Right,
we haven't transitioned entirely to oil yet, and I'm pretty sure you still have a lot of homes heated by coal in 1919.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Yeah. What really gets a lot of attention for some obvious reasons is that you have a strike by the Boston Police Force.
Wait. The Boston Police Force goes on strike?
Think about this.
I don't normally think of police forces going on strike.
Exactly. The long sweep of labor history, everyone goes on strike. Not the cops.
Yeah, right.
For maybe some pretty obvious reasons.
Strike busting,
yeah. Or also it's like the one group of public servants, if they're not there, what happens?
Well, exactly, yeah.
So you do actually have several nights of lawlessness in Boston.
Okay.
No one minding the store.
This is 1919, but...
1919.
But what month?
I think it's in the spring.
Okay. All right.
I should know this. Okay. It's in the spring. So the National Guard is deployed, not surprisingly, to sort of pick up the slack.
Yeah.
Long story short, the police union is crushed. The striking cops are fired and replaced. It's a big blow to organized labor. It makes organized labor look bad, as you might imagine. It also, not that people care, but it really boosts the career of one Calvin Coolidge.
Oh, that guy.
That guy. He was governor of Massachusetts at the time. And at the he's a pretty notoriously lackluster fellow. But at the time, he publicly said that basically there is no right. I'm just a paraphrase. But there is no right to strike against the public safety ever. It's like, this is the one group that shouldn't be allowed to strike.
And this gets him national attention.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the reasons why he's put on the Republican ticket as vice president in 1920. So then he's going to be, as you'll find out in 1923, a heartbeat away.
Yeah.
So you have massive, massive labor unrest. You also have this is not unique. I'm pretty sure you had a general strike in San Francisco in 1934.
Mm-hmm.
where the entire city shuts down. In case people don't know what a general strike is, no one works.
Right.
Usually it's in sympathy with some particular union that's on strike. That's certainly happened in San Francisco with the longshoremen.
It's more commonly known in European history.
Correct.
20th century European history.
If you know your German history, it's how they brought an end to this right-wing attempted coup in 1920, the Kapp-Putsch.
Right. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And it's if you can do it, it's amazingly effective. Because
yeah, it works
basically
in Britain, yeah.
The entire, in this case, the economy of Seattle just shuts down. If no one's working, nothing gets done.
There's a general strike in
There's a general strike
Seattle.
In Seattle. Yeah, I don't know many of the details, but I know that it's rare, and I know that's a good sign of labor unrest when you have an entire. And that was a serious city. This is not a small town.
Wait, so you got Boston, which is a huge city, must be in the top five in this stage, in the East, having a major part of its infrastructure go on strike. Then you have Seattle having a general strike.
Right.
This is
well, and you also the steel industry.
Yeah,
places like Pittsburgh and Chicago, other places are going to be deeply affected by that. Also, if you think about how many other industries are dependent on steel and how many
the knock-on effects.
Well, and the steel industry itself, right? I forget the order of the strikes, but a coal strike, no coal, no steel, basically, because that's all just going to remain lumps of iron ore. So it's, in terms of labor activism, and as we'll see in a minute, labor radicalism. This is one of the most, I almost said one of the most striking years, but that's a bad pun. Sorry, I'll see one of the most serious years in all of U.S. history. I don't think that's, I mean, right up there with things like 1877.
And we're still talking about 1 year, 1917. One year in 1919.
Right. And the context is everything in history. This is a wave of labor unrest that doesn't happen just at any time. It happens at a time when the broader public fears labor more than at most points in American history.
Okay.
In other words, because it seems like we're not just in a period of labor unrest, but in a period of radicalism.
Oh, okay.
And there are lots of pieces to this from before and during World War One. Even you have during World War One, you have the sort of the wave of hyper-nationalism.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
And sort of 100% Americanism, as the Klan would call it.
We see that.
You have a growing fear of the recent wave of immigration. And remember, there's this massive wave of immigration roughly between 1900 and the eve of World War One, 1914, when obviously it becomes difficult. And remember, these are not just any Americans. These are typically their ethnicities and religions and languages that we haven't seen typically.
Right.
These are not Germans. These are not Germans and Scots-Irish. These are Italians. These are Russian Jews. These are Greeks.
Right.
These are Hungarians, and these are considered by the more traditional people to be not the right sort of American.
Right.
So there's a lot of xenophobia coming into 1919. There's a fear not just of unions, but of other groups. For example, the IWW, the Industrial Workers
of the
World, which is a pretty radical group in America. It's reached its peak. It has 150,000 members in 1917.
Which is huge for such a group.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they are relatively radical. Mm-hmm. This is still the tail end of the heyday of violent anarchism.
Right.
Let's not forget that an anarchist
political movement. Yeah.
Right. Let's not forget it was an anarchist who assassinated William McKinley in 1901.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they had committed a lot of other assassinations around the world, in Europe in particular. So what does Barbara Tuchman call it? The idea and the deed, right? They want to bring about an anarchist utopia by some extreme act of
anarchic ways,
regicide or whatever. And then let's not forget, 1917, you also have the Bolshevik Revolution,
right? Which gets revolution, a lot of press coverage.
Well, absolutely, for good reason. It takes over a major country and immediately declares its intention to spread its revolution worldwide.
Yeah.
In other words, we're coming for you next.
Yeah.
And this is all going on at the same time, and it's all mutually reinforcing. Right now, there's the fear of foreigners. These foreigners are not just sort of immigrants of the wrong type or the wrong group. They're also maybe anarchists or communists.
Politically wrong, right.
Right, politically wrong, or a political threat. And a lot of this had been hopped up by World War One. So all this makes 1919 a peak year of what's called the Red Scare.
Oh, okay.
This, depending on how you count, lasts between 1917 and 1920, but 1919 is in some ways the peak year. This is the first, not the only, unfortunately, but the first major wave of anti-communist, anti-radical hysteria in the United States, hyped by the newspapers. Let's not forget about the role of the media. Remember, there's still no radio, no television. This early. It's newspapers and magazines.
There are a zillion newspapers.
There are a zillion newspapers who are locked in cutthroat competition with each other.
Yeah.
And you win with screaming headlines.
Yeah.
That push the fear button in people's psyches. So in April and let's also make clear that this is not entirely hype, that there is a real danger there.
Yes,
there are some
yes,
real radicals.
Right.
There, the magnitude of the threat and the number of the radicals is exaggerated. Mm-hmm. That's why it's called a scare. And there is hysteria that is way, way out of proportion. Nevertheless, in April, a plot is uncovered by the authorities, a plot by anarchists to mail 36 mail bombs to prominent public figures.
36 is a lot for when you're targeting prominent public figures.
And I won't bore you. You can go online. They've got the list. They've got the list of the targets, and includes people like J.P. Morgan.
Right.
And who else? The Attorney General of the United States.
Yeah.
And a lot of other folks. Now, they uncovered this plot before these bombs went off.
Oh,
I was going to say,
do any of them go off?
No, not in this group of bombs. These are headed off.
But were there aren't any bombs that ever did go off?
Yes. Not mail bombs and not any of those 36 bombs. But there's a subsequent flurry of bombs that did go off on June 2nd. That's the key date. June 2nd, 1919. Mm-hmm. Eight bombs went off in eight cities.
Wow.
Some of them sizable. People have a sense, or should have a sense, that an individual stick of TNT, a stick of dynamite, is rather powerful and doesn't weigh very much.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, note that some of these bombs were as large as 25 pounds of TNT.
My God,
that's a big bomb. It was pretty clear that they're anarchists who were at fault. The Attorney General, as of early 1919, is a fellow by the name of A. Mitchell Palmer,
mm-hmm.
who, in case people haven't heard of him, I would argue he's one of the more important attorney generals in U.S. history that a lot of people haven't heard of.
Oh, right.
Most attorney generals are not household names.
No,
FDR burned through them. I probably couldn't even name them all.
Yeah.
But he is appointed attorney general in early 1919, and his house in D.C. is bombed and badly damaged.
It's a major cabinet figure.
Absolutely.
Cabinet member.
Absolutely. The chief law enforcement officer in the United States. His house in D.C. is bombed.
Obviously
the
targeted.
The bomber was killed. No one else was killed. The bomb went off prematurely.
Uh-huh.
Interestingly, I was curious to find this out, people who were almost casualties of this bomb were Franklin Eleanor Roosevelt.
Oh, really?
Who lived across the street and apparently were walking right in front of Palmer's house just minutes before this went off.
This
so had
just
gone
coincidence.
Off.
They
pure
didn't know
coincidence.
They were gonna,
pure coincidence. Wow. But remember, FDR, he has not suffered from polio yet, in case you're wondering about that. He was Assistant Secretary of the Navy.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Before.
And he lived across the street in Palmer. And so they nearly were victims of this. One of the bomber's body parts landed on their doorstep across the street.
Oh my God. So this is a big bomb.
Gives you an indication of the magnitude of the explosion.
How did Palmer react?
It's my understanding that he was actually relatively chill on the issue of anarchists and radicals before this.
But when you put a bomb on my doorstep,
you're gonna get my attention. And then I would say, if anything, he overreacts and he leads what can only be called a ferocious crackdown.
Oh, okay.
You should also know, parenthetically, that he already at this point clearly has presidential ambitions.
Yeah, right.
Remember, there's a belief that Wilson's not going to run again for a third term. That's just the belief.
Sure.
This is before Wilson has
stroke,
a stroke,
yeah.
Incidentally. Palmer is ambitious, and so I'm pretty sure that he sees this as a sort of stepping stone, right? In other words, if you come out of this crisis as the great, strong leader who saved the country.
Saved it from anarchism, especially.
Oh, absolutely. Anarchism. Saves you from what seems to be the number one threat. Then, that would do wonders for your political career. So the United States had already landed very, very hard on radicals and the left during the war itself. Remember, this is the period of the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act, and people like Eugene Debs, the socialist. He's basically thrown in the penitentiary for giving a speech. I don't know if we talked about this in another episode, but if you gave a speech that was anti-war, you could be charged on the Espionage Act for interfering with the draft, right? In other words, someone in the audience
might
in the audience might listen to your speech and say, "Yeah, you know what? I'm not going to show up when I'm called." And then, so in other words, these were some very broad laws, and this was not a great period for the protection of American civil liberties.
Okay, so Palmer cracks down hard, but there had been this sort of
exactly
early
in a way he's just sort
hard.
Of resuming and intensifying
right,
a
right,
crackdown
right, right.
that's
gotcha,
already
gotcha.
Underway. In other words, gotcha. You already had this sort of government war against the extreme left. For example, during the war, they pulled the third class mailing privileges of left wing publications,
oh,
which basically meant publications like The Masses had to shut down because they couldn't ship their issues to people anymore.
They couldn't afford to.
That's right. Yeah. And you already had some, if you were a radical who opposed the war and you were an alien, in other words, you were not a U.S. citizen, they'd deport you. So some of this was already going on. This is not the invention of Mitchell Palmer.
Right,
but Palmer does things like things with some very long-term consequences, like hiring in August the 24-year-old J. Edgar Hoover.
Ah,
24
we've heard of
year
yeah, 24
old.
Years old. Yeah.
My God.
Yeah.
pretty much fresh out of law school. I mean, not entirely, but he's young. To head a new, the informal name was the Radical Division. I think it was called the General Intelligence Division.
Okay, but everybody else called it the Radical Division.
Right, just like when the police departments had Red Squads later on. They weren't actually called Red Squads. So it's the Radical Division of the, it wasn't the FBI yet. It was called the Bureau of Investigation. Later on,
it's also the
BI. It's going to get a name change later on too. So this is where he gets his start in this bureau. Hoover plays a major role in what are called the Palmer Raids.
Oh, right. Okay.
These have their own very long Wikipedia page for those of you who want to learn more about the Palmer Raids. They're really, really important. They're basically in two sort of spates, November 1919 and January 1920. Mm-hmm. They're basically these mass raids on the houses and offices of suspected radicals.
Right.
All across the country, although it's my understanding some of them, like in the Midwest and the West, are for show just to make it look like we're being fair, but they're mostly concentrated in eastern cities.
Yeah.
In New York City in particular. Immigrants, anarchists, Bolsheviks, people who have even remote ties to any of these groups are rounded up. Thousands of people are arrested.
Thousands?
Thousands. I couldn't nail down an exact number. Thousands, certainly.
But thousands is a lot.
It's a lot. It's a lot of people. Yeah, thousands of people arrested. And keep in mind that the federal government and the Justice Department and the Bureau of Investigation are not very big at this point.
No.
So this is a big ask. So thousands arrested. Over 500 aliens. In other words, some of these people are aliens. When they're arrested, they're found to be aliens. These are deported. I think some of them, this may have been earlier. I forget my chronology. But there was this one ship, the Buford, which was declared by the media to be the Soviet Ark. and I wish they were making it up. ARK, yes. Yeah. And so all these people, including Emma Goldman, by the way, were basically shipped off to Soviet Russia. You know, why don't you go back to Russia?
Go back to Russia.
Yeah, when you belong. And so hundreds of people were sent on that one ship. So in these Palmer raids, a lot of people's rights were violated.
Right.
I'll put it that way.
Constitutional rights.
Yeah, constitutional rights. A lot of these searches were without warrants. Some, even J. Edgar Hoover admitted that some of these arrests were needlessly brutal. And when Hoover admits that, we have a problem, right? How bad does it have to be if J. Edgar's like, wow, you guys are being mean? They beat the crap out of some of the people as they arrested them.
Yeah.
Not surprisingly.
What's the overall outcome of the raids?
Of the raids. So Palmer's big mistake came in 1920, and I realize this is the 1919 show, but some of the stuff spills over. Sorry.
Yeah. We can't.
History doesn't observe the calendar.
We can't be too rigid.
Palmer made the mistake of predicting, and Hoover did this too, predicting a major uprising nationwide on May Day 1920.
Now, let's remind the buzzkillers why May Day
was especially in left-wing, socialist, communist circles. Mm-hmm. This is the worldwide Labor Day.
Right.
Certainly well established by this point. It's obviously much bigger in Europe than it is in the United States.
Yeah.
But they believe that if American lefties are going to rise up, it's going to be on May Day.
So if it's coming, this is
when
it's going to happen.
That's when it's going to happen. And then it doesn't happen. And this was hyped by Palmer and everyone else beforehand. Right. Basically, people were whipped up into this sort of frenzy of fear, and then nothing happened. And so then Palmer was mocked.
Presidential ambitions probably.
Yeah, his reputation took a bit of a nosedive after that. And it didn't help that even inside the government, including the president, Wilson, who's recovering at this point, Wilson said, you know, basically, Mitch, you've gone a little bit too far.
Yeah, okay, yeah, calm down.
And he also, even early on, when the raids were going on, not all the rest of the government participated eagerly. The Department of Labor, which Justice depended on with a lot of these deportation cases, was not playing ball. The Department of Labor just didn't believe that this crackdown was warranted, and so they didn't cooperate. And this is a time when the then infant American Civil Liberties Union is starting to
ACLU,
gear up and become active in defending some of these people. There were also some judges who threw a lot of these cases out.
Yeah, sure.
So long story short, this sort of blew up in... bad, poor choice of words. This went poorly for Palmer, kind of backfired. He thought he was going to ride this to the White House, and then it turns out that he had been hyping the threat. Still. The threat, and so the threat and the level of hysteria subsides certainly by the middle of 1920.
Yeah.
But it is not, if you study any history of sort of American rights and civil liberties, this is not a shining moment for
people
like Palmer and law enforcement. Absolutely not.
And again, pretty intensive because it's only over what, 6 months or something?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So what else is going on?
Yeah. And I wish that were, you know, what I've explained so far is plenty.
Yeah.
But this is also, the summer of 1919 is also known infamously as the Red Summer.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is a...
Not red because of communists. Red
not exactly. Of, red because of blood. Exactly. You'd think it would have something to do with the Reds and not red blood. But basically, this is an additional low point in race relations in American history.
Right, right.
Coming after... Remember, this is in the depths of the Jim Crow period.
Yeah, and there's still Civil War veterans.
And we've talked about this in other episodes. Always worth reminding you what a horribly racist country the United States was.
Yeah, yeah. Either,
a rigid segregation in the South... De facto segregation everywhere else.
Right. We always forget that part.
Right. These are the peak years of Jim Crow. Lynchings aren't quite as common as they were in the 1890s, but still in the year 1918, 60 African Americans were lynched.
60.
So five a month. There were a few white people.
Yeah.
Or I should say there were a few non-blacks who were lynched, but it was a tiny number, something like 3 or 4. 60 African Americans were lynched in 1918. And now this is also, once again, context. This is in the middle of, or I should say maybe the tail end of the first burst of what's called the Great Migration.
Okay. These are people moving from the South to the North, mainly for wartime industrial jobs.
Right. Particularly, but it actually started before World War One. It accelerates World War One. Remember, there's a labor shortage, and
there's a labor shortage
in the North, and there the big companies in places like Chicago, they actually pay to have recruiters go to Mississippi.
Wow!
Just like who wants a job, basically?
Yeah,
we'll pay for your train ticket.
Yeah,
I mean it was that there. Wow. You know, by the way, these are not racially progressive people, but they're so desperate for labor.
No, right? They have to have
new factory hands just to fill their orders. Many, many African Americans, especially during World War One, are heading to the Northeast and the Midwest. Hundreds of thousands of people we're talking about. The population of Chicago, I just heard this little factoid. The population of Chicago, the black population of Chicago went from 40,000 to 100,000 in 5 years.
Wow.
So 60,000, 1,000 people a month.
God.
You know, it's a big city, but
yeah,
still,
but, even still, that's but
it's
a lot,
as a percentage increase of the black population, it is enormous. And in many cases, and you'd seen this well before World War One. In many cases, what this means is an increase in racial tension, because
certainly.
You had a lot of Northern whites who only find out how racist they are when black people show up.
Yeah, yeah,
right. Then they, of course, these same people who'd be looking down their noses at the Jim Crow South.
Yeah,
but then when the black family moves in, they flip their stuff.
And of course, Illinois in particular and Indiana are big north-southwest states orientation-wise.
Right.
And so you get a lot of Peoria and Indianapolis,
right.
And there are a lot of
Geography matters. And the major rail lines, basically, there's one that goes through Kentucky and Tennessee. There's one that goes up the East Coast, and there's one that goes up the Mississippi Valley.
Yeah,
and
right.
So people
right.
from Mississippi go to Chicago.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
people in South Carolina go to Boston, typically.
Yeah.
So this is happening all across the country. Hundreds of that. It's basically, it's one of the biggest, if not the biggest, internal migrations in all of American history. It lasts demographically, if you look at census figures, it goes until 1970. This increases a lot of racial tension in the North. And then on top of that, we have literally millions of white soldiers returning
mm-hmm.
to find their jobs, in some cases their neighborhoods, occupied by newly arrived African Americans.
Ah. And these are veterans who... in their own minds, at least, expect to get their own their old lives back.
Right, and if you leave a place that in your head is a white community and you come back and it's no longer a quote-unquote a white community
and you're a typically racist
white person, you're not going to take very kindly to it. Especially, you're going to look at it as a slap in the face. Look, I just served my country. I deserve to come back to a job and not have to live with black people.
Right.
And then it gets even, the brew or sort of the combination of factors gets even worse when you look at the fact that thousands and thousands of African Americans served in World War One.
Yeah, sure.
And they come back as W.E.B. Du Bois famously said, they returned fighting. In other words, not literally fighting, but fighting for their rights.
Yeah.
And so basically you have this newly assertive African American community that expects not to be treated like they did before because they've helped. Well, they fought for democracy.
Absolutely.
You can see this in World War II, by the way. Yeah. So they have heightened expectations. All of this is a recipe for violence.
And how does that recipe manifest itself?
Right. So what resulted from the recipe? Well, on the one hand, more lynchings.
Yeah.
The number of lynchings of African Americans goes up to 76. there were, and it's I'm not going to depress people even further if you read about some of these individual events, but there were African Americans in uniform who were lynched.
This is just disheartening and, beyond belief.
And let's just keep in case, and we talked about this in another episode, but in case anyone is sort of unclear on this, these are not typically quick and dirty murders.
Oh, no, 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 no.
They are people being tortured
no.
to death, yeah, and, sometimes over hours.
And sometimes there's a sort of celebratory
absolutely.
Element.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Like a crowd yeah. gathers.
And yeah. lynch photography and lynch postcards. We talked about this. Those are still
a
thing.
Awful.
Once again, it's not as, I mean, it's all relative. It's not as bad as the 1890s.
No.
But that's,
yeah.
That's, no, I mean, it's still awful.
It's all bad. And, but the African American veterans in uniform is really, really, yeah, really, really
right. And by the way, and that, the fact that there were black people in uniform, and you see the same thing in World War II. Really seemed to set off whites even more,
yeah.
right? Because it was just so it was so outrageous that black people were allowed to fight for their country, basically.
Yeah.
If you're a racist white person,
yeah.
So much more serious than that is, if that were possible, is the fact that you have a whole wave of race riots
mm-hmm.
in the summer mm-hmm. of 1919. Mm-hmm. Depending on how you count, I've seen the official count of 38 separate riots.
Wow.
And you know that, so then that doesn't count individual murders or small scale
right.
events.
These yeah,
are
yeah.
38 race riots. And let's be clear: in this time period, race riots typically meant large mobs of white people invading black neighborhoods,
right,
and committing acts of assault, rape, murder, arson. And the by far the worst riot. And I should also add there, in terms of the death and injured toll, they mm-hmm. are worse. In this, they're worse and slash better, if this is going to sound odd, because African-Americans are fighting back much more than they would have in an earlier riot.
Okay, okay.
So, for example, if you look at by far the worst individual riot, this is the one in Chicago.
Yeah.
Entire books have been written about this. I urge people to look into it. There are even some good podcasts about this. Chicago, starting in late July 1919, 38 people are killed.
Okay.
23 of them black, 15 white. Which is not a ratio you would have seen.
Before,
you have
yeah.
not have seen. And by the way, there were people, you can go online and see pictures of people, not people dead, but people being killed.
Yeah.
In other words, photographs taken yeah. while someone is being stoned to death with bricks.
Yeah.
These were taken at the time. So there's some really good documentation on this. The one in Chicago was triggered, as people may know, when in Lake Michigan, it was informal Jim Crow. You had unofficial mm-hmm, white mm-hmm. swimming areas mm-hmm. and black swimming areas. And there was a black teenager who strayed into the water off of the white beach.
Right.
And they start stoning him and he ends up drowning. And that quickly leads to crowds and a cop refusing to arrest a white person who the black people thought had thrown the stone. And this basically spins out of control. And you end up with days and days and days of just rampant rioting. Between 1,000 and 2,000, mostly black homes were burned to the ground. A lot of this was arson.
Wow.
And often, if you were like a black family who lives near a white neighborhood,
yeah,
they'll come and burn your house down because they don't like living near you.
Yeah, it's too close.
And you know, you had police taking part in the riot, or you had police refusing to, you know, arrest people who they had witnessed commit a murder.
Mm.
So the police were part of the problem, not surprisingly. So, and this happened all over the place. Like I said, yeah, hundreds of dead. So you had some of the most serious racial mayhem in all of American history in 1919.
Well, it sounds, and it was obviously awful, and it sounds like things are really going down the tubes. But let's take this time to take a little break, and we'll get back to try to hear more about and try to understand why things are going so downhill so quickly.
Hello, this is Liz Buzzkill, the Vice President for Long Range Planning at the Buzzkill Institute. Don't tell the professor I told you this, but there isn't going to be much of a long range future for this podcast, and frankly, this institute, unless we shore up our financial bottom line. The Duke of Buzzkill is threatening to turn off the money machine. Loyal Buzzkillers can help support the show by going to ProfessorBuzzkill.com, clicking on the Support the Show Patreon button. For as little as $1 per month, you can become a peasant in Buzzkill Society and help keep it alive. Not only that, even the lowest orders will receive exclusive content every month. Our popular Man Crush Monday and Women Crush Wednesday shows are only available to peasants, squires, knights, and nobles in the Duchy of Buzzkill. Other fantastic rewards are available in the higher orders. Check it all out by going to ProfessorBuzzkill.com and clicking on the Support the Show Patreon button. And of course, you can follow us on all the social media by going to relevant links on the website. Remember, don't tell the professor I said we're going to be broke soon.
Okay, we're back. Now, Professor, before the break, we talked about, you talked about all these race riots and especially not only the deaths, but all the property damage in big cities, big places, and lots of places. So it seems like the country is going to hell.
Right. You know, in a place like Chicago, right after the riot, if you were looking at the city skyline from a distance, it would seem like half the city was on fire. Same thing happened. There was a big riot in D.C., by the way, in the nation's capital. So, yeah, you could be forgiven if you thought the entire country was going to hell. And I should just add, just insert right here, that this list we've just, list of problems and events and disasters that I've just gone through is not complete. I haven't said anything about the fighter of the League of Nations. I haven't said anything about Wilson's near-fatal stroke.
Yeah,
although we kind of talked about that in another episode. We didn't say anything about the rigged World Series.
The rigged World Series?
The rigged World Series. We just finished the World Series. Yeah. Yes. By the way, people shouldn't exaggerate, in this one sense, the importance of this, because there were other, maybe not other World Series, but there were other baseball games and professional sports games that were rigged.
In this time period,
including going back in the 19th century.
But this gets the biggest splash.
It sure does. This is the Black Sox scandal. This is the extremely good, even dominant Chicago White Sox team of 1919. There is a good movie out there I recommend called Eight Men Out, which is based on the book of that title. However, I listened to a podcast about this, and apparently there are some myths to be busted in that book and in that movie, as good as it is.
Basically, all movies, of course.
But here, look at me complaining about Hollywood history movies. Who knew? So, eight Chicago White Sox players took bribes from professional gamblers in order to make money on the series, in return for which they would deliberately lose the series, which they did.
By the way, they weren't immediately punished.
They played... Almost all of them played in the 1920 season.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. I thought that was
They're not arrested and tried until after that.
Oh, okay.
And only one of them, I think, had not re-signed with the team, or didn't play with the team. So they were famously acquitted at trial, but then banned for life from Major League Baseball by Kennesaw Mountain Landis,
The famous
hard ass, if I can use that term, who was brought in deliberately to clean up baseball by the owners.
And by the way, I
read about this. The owners wanted, you know, some limits on his power. And he basically said, in effect, no. You give me unlimited power over the sport or I walk.
And his argument was, this is such a bad public relations scandal. If this doesn't look like I've cleaned it up completely, Red Cross sanitation wise, then you're gonna.
That's right, and that's why. And you know, from the little I read about this, I got the impression that in a way, at least in terms of public relations, he succeeded. In other words, the reputation of the sport was restored. The cost was for these eight players who were banned for life, and by implication, also banned from the Hall of Fame for life, including famously Shoeless Joe Jackson.
But this is a big deal because it sort of strikes right at the heart of one of the images of American purity, baseball.
That's right.
You know,
it's part of the trilogy with Mom and Apple Pie, isn't it?
That's right, exactly.
Right,
and as more American, Shoeless Joe Jackson was a hero,
right? And by the way, there is a mini myth. Can I bust a mini myth,
please?
Apparently, no kid ever said to him outside the courthouse, "Say it ain't so, Joe."
Oh, that's right.
There was a sports writer who wrote that line.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Now and then, it was put in the. He played a lot of semi-pro ball, which is actually shown in the movie, I think, at the end.
And by the way, these White Sox players, this is the Yankees before, you know, these guys are huge stars.
Oh, absolutely, right. But remember, this is during the early days of no free agency and the reserve clause.
They
were well paid. And by the way, that's another myth, is how badly treated they were by Charles Comiskey. Yeah. He was not a great guy necessarily.
No.
But in 1919, the Chicago White Sox had the highest payroll. And the movie kind of depicts them as sort of these oppressed.
The Eight Men Out movie.
The Eight Men Out movie. It wasn't quite that bad. It's my impression that the players basically saw an opportunity to supplement their incomes.
And they were paid
just like $5,000, which back then was a lot of money. But they got caught and their careers were ruined.
What amazes me about all this stuff is that there's all this very serious racial violence, all this tension about radicals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Even baseball doesn't seem to be free of any kind of taint.
Right.
The effects of all this must have been enormous.
Sure, right. You know, and that's and I think it's a good place to end, because you can imagine a year that's stuffed full of these sorts of events, and then maybe it doesn't have any, right? Then maybe you get over it, quote unquote. Well, it has some effects. It has some big effects in the 1920 election. Now, let's keep in mind, you've had two terms of Woodrow Wilson, or almost two terms. You have the toward the end of his term where he's not really hands on the wheel, shall we say, where he's recovering from a near fatal stroke. But so in other words, you might have had a Republican on a change of party in 1920 anyway. But you do have the 1920 election, where 1919 played a big role. I love this election, partly because it's where two Ohio newspaper editors face off against each other, which happens every day in American politics.
As you once said years ago in one of the early shows, two Ohio newspaper editors who never appear on our money.
Exactly, right.
They're not,
right,
they're
exactly.
not successful enough as presidents.
Right. James Cox, where are you now?
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's the Democrat, and with his running mate Franklin Roosevelt, often forgotten, he could have been a heartbeat away in the 20s.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's Warren G. Harding who gets all the attention, because he ends up winning, and winning big, by the way.
Yeah.
It's a landslide in the popular vote. He wins 60.3% of the vote.
Wow.
And that's partly about 1919.
Yeah, yeah.
He famously, at the time, I looked this up. He didn't coin the term normalcy. Apparently,
right.
It does, because there are people at the time who's like, you just made up a word.
Yeah, that's right.
Why didn't you just use the word normality?
Yeah,
he said normalcy.
Or just
right?
Return to normal.
Yeah. Right. But apparently, it was already a word. To his credit, I guess.
Yeah. Shakespeare's
He promised to. He said what? Nostrums, not normalcy.
Yeah, right. Right.
In other words, he recognizes, he has his finger on the pulse of America, basically. He recognizes that Americans in 1920 are tired of all the chaos, of all the bedlam. And not just that, but they're tired of change. They're tired of they're tired of crusades. They're tired of because keep in mind, under Wilson, we crusade at home for progressivism and progressive causes, and we crusade overseas against the Germans and against autocracy and et cetera, et cetera, right? Make the world safe for democracy. He recognizes that most Americans have had enough of all this.
Yeah, even you know, in theory, positive events like the 19th Amendment passing.
Right.
That is a lot of change.
Right, exactly. Yeah, right. Even the good stuff is, for a lot of people, happening too fast.
Yeah, obviously, your 19th Amendment, the not granting women right to vote, but preventing discrimination against women.
Correct. Absolutely right. Yeah, and of course, we didn't even talk about prohibition.
No, yeah, right?
So these are all coming to a head, and a lot of people basically seek an end to the turmoil.
Right.
Basically, there's a reason why most historians would agree that around 1920 is what you have the end of the progressive era.
Yeah, okay.
It's because of that election, and that election is, like I said, largely about 1919. But you have other effects that are partly about 1919, and that's, if you look at very topical, our immigration laws, which are famously and radically changed in the 1920s. There was an Emergency Act in 1921 and the more famous National Origins Act of 1924.
Yeah.
Where an overt, and I mean overt, attempt is made to turn back the clock to our ethnic profile circa 1890.
Right. This is before the big second.
Before the latest, the pre-World War I surge of immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And basically to, as its proponents see it, reestablish the dominance of white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, essentially.
Right.
And so it's an openly discriminatory law. It's going to be basically in place until 1965.
Yeah, it's practically like they have the maps in the legislation itself.
Absolutely.
They don't, but they're practically.
Yeah, and by the way, if buzzkillers are interested, they should go and see some of the outrageously bigoted things that politicians are saying on the floor of Congress in defense of these bills.
Yeah,
it's just amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
And
they almost as if it's anti-racial. It's saying they're not that far from Africans.
They don't make good Americans, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, they're basically flushing the entire argument about how this country's a melting pot and we take people from all over and we make great Americans out of everybody.
Yeah.
Right.
Flushing that down the
Because these are not Native Americans who are making this argument.
exactly. Yeah.
They're nativists, as they were called. And so basically after 1924, if you're British or if you're French or if you're Norwegian, come on in.
German.
And if you are...
Some Germans.
If you are... Yeah, because this is going to be a problem in the Holocaust, obviously. Yeah. But if you are Italian or if you're Polish or if you're Russian, forget about it. You need not apply because you're not getting in.
Yeah, particularly that Southeastern Europe idea that these are the grubby... Greeks and right. the grubby Bulgarians, and just really, yeah. really very nasty.
And as today, we have policies and laws being made based on stereotypes.
Yeah,
and a right. lot of these stereotypes come directly from 1919. Yeah. In other words, they're not just foreigners, yeah. but these are Jews, these are Catholics, these are anarchists, these are Bolsheviks, mm-hmm. these are bomb throwers. These are people who are going to not only not become good Americans, they're going to destroy this country. They're going to attack people, yeah. they're going to blow stuff up, and we just need to keep them out.
We need can't get rid of them.
Right. In other words, anti-radical yeah. and anti-immigrant sentiment are merged.
Right.
Basically.
Right.
Because remember, a lot of people deported in the Palmer Raids. Those are aliens.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Because yeah.
then yeah, yeah. they're the people you can make disappear because they don't enjoy the rights and liberties of citizens.
This is the
right?
way. This is one of the ways in which the 20s roar in, in a negative direction.
And in some not good ways, absolutely. So like I'll just repeat my earlier point, which is, you know, sometimes individual years pack in so many sort of major, even cataclysmic events that they have lasting ripple effects. And 1919 is one of those years.
Yes, and like we like to say, Buzzkill, is it's all very complicated, and the deeper you get even into individual years, there's more detail, there's more complication, there's more going on than most people normally think. So it just remains for us to say thank you, Professor Nash, once again. And
my pleasure.
Buzzkillers, please, of course, go to our website and do all the things you do at the website, and we'll talk to you next week.